Hello and welcome to Inside the Pod. This is a special episode about the descriptive list today, and we're actually at PGRO headquarters, and I'm joined by Dr. Chris Judge. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
No worries.
Chris has actually just talked us through the descriptive list for 2025, and the video is now live on YouTube. So if you want the full presentation with all of the stats and be able to look at his slides, then that's the place to go to. But if you're listening in and you just want to know what's being announced on this year's list, then stay tuned and check the data later. We've also had a chat with a couple of the breeders who have told us a little bit about their new varieties that they brought onto the list for 2025. And we're also talking about the trends that we're seeing in the industry towards new varieties and how they're being bred. So that'll come into a little bit later in the episode. But for now, I want to talk to Chris about the headlines from this year's list. Chris, so sure. For those people who haven't seen any of the data so far, what do you think the main headlines are in terms of your work over the past 12 months?
Sure, thanks for that. I guess it's a very different situation for beans and peas, so we'll tackle them separately. For beans, they've had a very good year this year in 2024. Very hard sowing conditions in terms of heavy waterlogging in the winter and in the early spring. We're struggling to get things drilled, but the things that did get in, we've had some real bumper yields, which is then obviously then very good for adding things with nice strong yield differences to the descriptive list data set. Winter beans is always fairly slow progress in new varieties. We often only get one or two each year. We had two last year, we've got one this year. But it's nice that we are still getting that breeding effort, that there is always new material moving forwards. Again, a lot of the winter bean market is quite similar to each other. You've not got the same level of variation and variety than you do, especially in the peas is the most extreme, and then probably then the spring beans in the middle, then the winter beans. But even just things like having a slightly better disease rating or a slightly earlier variety doing well does give the farmer options to really tailoring what they grow to the market. So we've got one new winter bean this year, as I said, and it's an earlier variety. And so whilst it's not coming in at the top of the yield, it's the highest yielding one that's as early as it is. So if you're growing a sort of a farm system where you want the beans off the field really quickly because your rotation involves you putting in something quite soon afterwards, again, having earlier varieties on the list really makes that a possibility. And again, also, if you're growing further north up the country and getting things off the field is more of a priority, again, having earlier material available really opens up options, which is true for the spring beans as well as the winters.
I suppose this is the whole thing about a descriptive list, is that you're giving growers the data to allow for them to choose a variety that fits their system.
Yeah, and obviously there's only so many traits we can show, there's only many traits that are sort of feasible to test, but you just need to let people know what is out there, let people know what breeders have worked on, and test it independently, not in conjunction with a set breeder choosing their favourite bits of data. You know, test it on a range of soil types in a range of different conditions over multiple years, multiple sites, so that then we can say, you know, in general, on average over that time period, these behave like this, these behave like this, and then you present that information neutrally for farmers to choose from.
So just the one winter bean. Spring beans, how are they looking? How many new varieties have we got?
So we've got four new varieties of spring bean. As I said, one of them is an LVC one, as we were just talking about LVC. We've got two others that have yielded really well and are coming in at the top of the list. And the fourth one has got really good disease scores. So good news on all four fronts, that each of them has got a trait that would sort of recommend them to a certain person's circumstance.
Yeah. So yes, good news there, and some nice new varieties for people to have a look at. And on the pea side, it's been quite a busy year for you in terms of combining peas.
Yeah. Again, the real takeaway on the pea front is that there's a lot of new yellow peas. We've actually got only one new green pea, one new marrowfat, but the new green pea has gone straight to the top of the green yield. The new Marifat's gone straight to the top of the Marifat yields. So if they're what you're interested in growing, that's really new, exciting material on that front. Again, it may not be easy to get seed of them for the first year that they're on the list. They're probably still being heavily multiplied up, but you can take note of them and sort of look for them in the future. But it's, again, it's nice when new material comes in doing better than things that are already there. It really shows the value that's been generated from the plant breeders.
And in your line of work, you must have hundreds of conversations with growers about varieties and variety traits. Yield is always perhaps the one that's the most eye-catching and the headline one that a lot of people will talk about. But with the way that the industry is developing and the way it's going, you've touched on a couple of points already in this conversation, but what would you say the traits that are perhaps attracting a bit more attention now from growers than used to in the past?
Again, as you say, yields are always going to be big. Thinking about end market use is always going to be big. You know, if somebody's been offered a good Marifat contract, they're instantly zooming in on the Marifats. Disease rating, always important. Obviously, you can mitigate a low disease rating in your spraying plan and schedule, but also they're even more important if you're an organic grower, for example. I think there's a potential for, particularly within the sort of the future development of the industry, perhaps not happening quite now, I think protein percentage may raise in importance as a trait for some people. Again, there is an increased market for protein extra dates and protein flours and things that, you know, any marginal differences in protein percentage can sort of add up. Obviously, you need to consider the yield at the same time. There's also, I think, an increased interest in virus resistance. So for the first time this season, we're showing some virus information we've got from breeders. So this isn't something that's been done at PGRO. We haven't had a big aphid cage and done lots of detailed virus work. That's incredibly expensive and needs a sort of a dedicated entomologist team to be doing. But we have asked all of the breeders, do you know any information from your breeding source about virus resistance? And again, there's two breeders where they have got that in their material and that's been put on the list. And then a third breeder, I think possibly a fourth actually thinking about it, they've said, not yet, but it's in our breeding program. I know there's one that's with it. If it keeps progressing and keeps doing well, they'd probably enter the list in 2 years' time. Right. That then would be from a different company also with virus resistance. I think it is where I think it is a trait that will be increasingly bred into peas.
So that's being displayed on the list as a sort of note, is it? Because obviously the rest of the list is very much data that's independently produced by you, and you're now asking breeders to provide their own information on certain bits. So just explain how that kind of works in terms of what you're saying.
Like, even before this, the powdery mildew information we showed was always breeder supplied. It's always on the list in square brackets saying information provided by the breeder, just because having reliable natural powdery mildew infection to a degree that leads to sensible scoring is quite an undertaking.
Yeah.
And also, if you let powdery mildew infection occur within a yield trial to a sufficient level, it can then be affecting the quality and the yield results then you get out of the trial. You'd need it set up separately. And it's unlike some of the other diseases which you get reliably most seasons, powdery mildew is a bit more condition dependent. So with that, we work on, you know, a lot of the breeders as part of their breeding programs and as part of their testing and part of their whole program that's led up to the point where they're going onto the descriptive list, they will have already had marker testing for powdery mildew resistance genes, and they will have probably also had like infected inoculated tunnel tests and things as part of their early screening process. So the breeders often have that information, and then it's purported as breeder information on its own column. So the virus situation is very similar to that, that it's a similar conversation with a breeder where we say, do you have any existing information about this that we can report? And then it is reported on the list with a note saying this is information from the breeder rather than by PGRO. That's very transparent. And like all of the rest of the information on, like you say, on yield, on standing, on say downy mildew, yeah, say rusting beans, that has all come from the PGRO testing.
That extra information, I think, like I say, given the drive towards using fewer insecticides, it's got a bit, got to help, I guess, in some way. So, and finally, Chris, the work never stops. You'll already be working well onto your 2026 descriptive list. How's drilling gone so far? Because it's actually snowing outside, for those of you who are watching online. It's snowing outside today. How's the crop gone in for you?
Yeah, it's been a much easier winter drilling season than certainly the last 2 years, arguably the last 3 years, where we've been quite tricky, rainy conditions through late October and early November. So at PGRO, we've already drilled all our winter bean trials, including the ones for the descriptive list. I haven't spoken to all of the trials operators that do the winter beans drilling elsewhere in the country, but the ones I have spoken to have also got theirs in, and I just need to double check in with the others, but I would think it's highly likely that everyone's got sorted, just because the weather has been mild and conditions have been good for pretty much the last 3 weeks. It's just got cold and a bit snowy this week, but I would suspect most people have got theirs in. I haven't checked in with everyone. Anyone who I have spoken to has either said, yes, it's done, or I'm doing it tomorrow. And that was a week or so ago when I spoke to that person, so that I'm assuming that's gone in okay.
Good. Well, yeah, it can't have been much worse than last year anyway, so that's a good step forward. We're going to hear from a couple of our breeders now, so we're going to jump over to that section. So I'm delighted to be joined now by Heather Oldfield, who is the Cereals and Pulses Product Manager for UK and Ireland for Limagrain. Thanks for joining us today, Heather.
Hi, Ben. No, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're going to touch on a few things through this interview, just so that growers get an idea of what happens from the breeder side and how these varieties even get to Chris Judge and the PGRO team for the descriptive list trials. But perhaps before we dive into that, Heather, I appreciate you're quite new to Limagrain. Do you want to tell us, you joined on, I think, the 1st of September was your first day around that date. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, absolutely, Ben. So I have worked in the agricultural trade all of my life, my working life. I have traded cereals, pulses, malting barley, oilseed rape and all the rest of it from a futures perspective into homes, directly from farm into homes. And then I've worked for another seed breeder for the last 10 years, looking after the energy, forage and hybrid cereals and business development. I also sit on NFU National Combinable Crops Board as well, which is really useful to get a wider farmer perspective and an idea of what's going on farm across the country. And then we also farm at home in Lincolnshire. We are arable and beef farmers.
So we've just heard from Chris Judge, who's talked us through the descriptive list for 2025. Limagrain has got two varieties on there. We've got a combining pea and a spring bean. And I'm conscious this is fairly old, you know, the role is fairly new to you, Heather, so you've probably not been involved in the whole programme bringing this one to the trials. But from your perspective, what can you tell us about the two varieties that are on the list for this year?
So in terms of field peas, we've got LG Corvette new for this year. It's high yielding field pea. It's got a very good downy mildew score of 8. Its protein's pretty high, and it seems to hold its colour, and we'll see how it gets on this year. The samples, the physical samples that I've seen from this last harvest and the year before look pretty good. We've had those in trial with yourselves and then on a couple of private trials as well. And I'm looking forward to getting it out into the UK market.
So that's LG Corvette. What can you tell us about LG Eagle, our new spring bean?
So we're absolutely delighted that it's come out as top of the list, joint top. It's got a good all-round package. We will have a limited amount of seed available in the spring. We'll be looking to multiply as much as possible to then go out to commercial market in 2026.
That's great. And in case you missed it on the presentation from Chris Judge earlier, the
yield is 110%, which is the joint top of the spring bean list, which is good news. What sort of importance do you put on the descriptive list trials into as a company? Is it how do you think growers use that information when it comes to them?
So being a grower myself as well, I think the PGRO, the list, descriptive list is important because it's the one place where you can compare all varieties and sort of see how they've done against each other over the last couple of years, whether they're consistent or not, looking at disease scoring and that sort of thing. Going forward, I'd perhaps like to see a little bit more from the list, especially if we're seeing as an industry, a move away from soya products into certain animal feeds. It would be great to see a bit more detail around nutritional value for peas and beans.
What specific nutritional values would you like to see on there as a farmer yourself? What kind of things would help you make that decision?
So protein, we already have that on the list. It would be quite useful to see starch and ME. So metabolizable energy, when I can get the words out, just to give a better indication. But also, if there's any active trials running, like I know we have private trials running at the moment, looking at feeding peas and beans into cattle, comparing it with soya diet, and then getting figures around, because they're weighing the cattle regularly, around average daily weight gain, days to finish, how they're finishing, kill out percentage, and so on. Maybe somewhere in the background, as the industry progresses and potentially adopts more homegrown proteins, it would be useful to see that information, particularly from a livestock perspective.
Yeah, that sort of brings us on to something I know we wanted to talk about relating to the NCS project, which Nitrogen Climate Smart Project. For those of you who haven't been paying attention on the podcast when we've been talking about it the last 18 months or so, Limagrain are involved in the project, aren't they?
We're not a consortium member, unfortunately, because I think the project started last spring and I've obviously only been in post since September. And we have a new breeder as well that's joined us this year. So, but we have put various varieties, winters, out onto trial with a number of growers just to see how they get on, how they yield, disease score, whatever else, and how they fit within their rotation. So I think some growers are looking at using farmyard manure. Some are looking at rooting systems, different treatments, that sort of thing. And then what I would like to do is do the same in the spring, obviously including our new variety, Corvette.
Yeah. So when you're sort of bringing digressing slightly from the NCS, we'll come back to it, but when you're bringing a variety to the PGRO, how much work is involved before it kind of even gets to that stage from your side? Just, I think there's a bit like with agrochemicals, you only ever see the finished products when you're a farmer. You don't perhaps see all the stuff that goes into it behind it, but how much work and time and money is involved in actually bringing a variety to the DL?
So I think there's an awful lot of work and time and effort that goes into this. And I think perhaps as growers, I know when I speak to friends that farm, and they ask similar questions, they don't maybe understand sort of the number of years that goes into breeding new varieties of wheat, malting barley, peas, beans, whatever it might be. But we do an awful lot of work in Europe where we're looking at sort of different genetics and germplasm. And then what we'll do is we'll bring those genetics to the UK. We'll screen and trial them here on our own site and down at Woolpit. And then whichever comes out better, we will look to enter into the DR program. So, you know, it could be sort of 8-10 years in the making.
Yeah, it's quite a considerable amount of time and obviously investment that goes along with that as well, which I think is important to know. And when you're selecting, you mentioned genetics there, when you're selecting certain features or qualities of a variety, what is it that you think you favour as a breeder, or that as a grower, what is it that you're particularly looking for at the moment? I mean, Corvette has got the highest downy mildew rating for a yellow pea, which is at 8 for this year, I've got here in the notes. So it's stuff like that, isn't it? What do you think the sort of growers are looking for in the UK climate from the varieties?
I think from any sort of crop that you're looking to grow, as a farmer, you want the highest yield, and you want a good, robust disease package. And almost in a way, that's it for a lot of growers, unless you're feeding cattle at home, and we've talked about, or whatever else, chickens or and so on. So for us as breeders, I think it's important that we focus on those two things. But it's always about getting a balance. So because often the problem is with breeding that you add something else in, you add another gene in that creates another level of resistance, and then you get a yield drag. So it's really about balancing the two and seeing what's more appropriate for market. And then when you're thinking about blues, of course, we want something that retains colour. And then sort of speaking to the trade at the moment about the yellows, they often for the new markets that have sort of progressed over the last 5 to 10 years, fractionation, they're looking at something that's more tasteless. So it's okay, how do we breed for that? And how do we move forward with that? And is there something that we can pinpoint that leads to that outcome? So, and I think it's important to always be horizon scanning and keeping up with those markets and seeing what we've got in our portfolio, because you might throw it away, because it might not be quite the highest yielding, but it might have a use for market. And I think it's really important to have those close relationships with processors so that they have an understanding of what our portfolio is and how we can move forward.
And I think one of the things that we've already mentioned, and it's going to be quite important going forward, is this this whole displacing imported soya from a variety of feed, any sort of livestock. I know we talked about the NCS project, you're sort of looking into this at home as well, aren't you, in terms of what you can do as a cattle farmer to be able to displace soya, just from more of a farmer's perspective. How far have we got to go in that journey, do you think? Have you already started the sort of process, or are you waiting for solutions?
So to give you an idea at home, we have a lot of vining peas grown local to us. And we tend to follow the viners and bale and wrap the peon, which is a fantastic cattle feed, and some of which, depending on breed and animal and so on, we can actually finish them on it without having to put any sort of total mixed ration in place, which is great. And I think when you look at what's going on within industry, there's a number, and it's not just ruminants, it's monogastrics as well. So people seem to be looking at their carbon footprints, their environmental footprint, and how they can reduce emissions, how they can hit certain targets that are being legislated. And if we can have more homegrown proteins and replace that imported soya, it can only be a good thing. Now, I was speaking to a farm last Wednesday, and I think one of the bigger barriers at the moment is soya is relatively cheap, and it's always going to be that trade-off. So until it's a chicken and egg, and until we have that market established, and those, until we know how to feed cattle or whatever they might be en masse for the best end results, and if we've got the processing of that in place, this infrastructure in the country, it's going to be hard to get farmers to actually put the crop in the ground if they then grow something that then they can't sell and it's not profitable and cash flow and everything else.
Yeah, I think this conversation does tend to go around in circles a bit, doesn't it, with that there is a huge desire to do this, and I think farmers will adopt it if it's obviously it's got to be financially viable, it's got to be simple, and it's got to be at no detriment to the quality of the feed, and probably at lots of other things as well, but that does seem to come around time and time again. But it does feel like, I don't, from where we're sitting anyway, it does feel like progress is being made, but it is going to take time to get there. Do you sort of share that opinion?
I agree. I think there are, as a farmer, everybody's looking for a viable break crop at the moment, particularly with oilseed rape area declining. And while SFI has given people some options, at the majority of farmers' core, they want to grow food. They want to, you know, something that's productive. And the unintended consequences of SFI, as we know, are that for pea and bean growers, we've got more legumes in the rotation, which is going to have a negative impact. And I think if we could have some more sort of structure or potentially some more funding in place to incentivize growers to put crops in the ground of peas and beans, then you would improve biodiversity on farm, soil structure, potentially less inputs in the following wheat crop or whatever you're following your peas or beans with, and less imports of soy, which can only be a good thing.
Sounds great. I mean, that's, yeah, speaking straight from the Bible of the NCS project there, that's exactly what we're trying to achieve with that. And I think, you know, it, like I said, does, as we always say on our podcasts and all of our communications channels, peas and beans have such great environmental profile that often get overlooked. So I think that's an important point to reinforce. That's great. Thanks, Heather. Thanks for your time talking to us today and introducing yourself to the podcast. And I wish you all the best in your role. And I look forward to seeing what Limagrain's got for us going forward.
That's great. Thanks, Ben.
So joining us now is Michael Sholdham, who is the Pulse Product Manager at NPZ. Good afternoon, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Ben. Thanks very much for having me.
You're very welcome. And NPZ, if you haven't heard of it before, Michael's going to explain, because you're probably, those who are listening, more familiar with LSPB, but that name obviously changed some time ago now, Michael. But do you want to just explain that for those who perhaps haven't registered that?
Yeah, absolutely. We changed from LSPB back in May. It was a bit of a natural progression for the business, really. We're wholly owned by the German plant breeder, NPZ, in Germany. And originally we were set up as a joint venture between two companies, NPZ Lemke and Sericem. And we've been wholly owned by NPZ for 10 years and kept the LSPB name going. Many people know our varieties under the name LSPB, but just to sort of take the business forward, make it a bit more straightforward as where the varieties come from, we went with the name NPZ to line up with our shareholders.
And to keep all of us on our toes, for those of you who have been referring to you for 10 years as one name, we now have to remember that it's NPZ. So yes, thanks for explaining that. So Michael's just going to run us through the additions to the list that NPZ's got for growers now. I don't know whether you want to start with peas and beans, Michael, but what's new for growers from you this year?
I think we could start from a natural place for us as NPZ UK. People probably know us best for our spring bean varieties, and over quite many years now, Vertigo, leading into Lynx and Genius, which came on the list a few years ago. I'm really, this year, it just adds to that for us, strengthening the depth of our portfolio, particularly with the new variety Ketu, which has been listed. Now, this variety is very exciting. It brings LVC varieties not just into line with the classic HVC or high vitamin and convitamin varieties like Lynx. It actually outyields most of them. So this is a real step change for spring beans. Not only that, it's got a really good rust score and it's got a decent downy mildew score there. So I think for growers now looking at growing a spring bean, the question isn't what is LVC and should I be growing that? It is just what is the best bean for me to be growing this year? And then is there an added benefit to having that LVC? And that market is developing. And I think really as the varieties develop, the market's going to develop with it. So yeah, a really exciting new one for us, right up there at the sharp end of the spring bean list. Along with that, we're still breeding your normal high vitamin varieties, and Loki comes alongside Ketu this year. It's got a nice rounded variety with a big seed size and a good downy mildew score.
Ketu, for those who haven't got the numbers in front of them, the yield
is 107% for Ketu, which is strong, and just sort of 3% behind the one at the top of the list. So what we've talked a little bit already on this episode, Michael, about low vicin varieties. I guess a lot of growers will be aware of why the market has sort of moved and developed in that area a bit more. But from your point of view, why is that becoming perhaps a little bit more important in breeding programs?
Well, we take it back to the start. We actually started looking at low vicin and convicin quite a long time ago in terms of the benefits you can get in feeding, particularly monogastric animals, but actually all animals and humans. So from one angle, you get improved feed efficiency, also improved rations, because you can include more beans in a ration when you're using low vicin and convicin. Because they're anti-nutritional factors, if you include too much of them in particularly susceptible monogastric animals' diets, their performance drops. Worst case, they actually start to get sick. With low vicin and convicin, the levels are that low that we can increase them fairly confidently in diets. And it's that twofold effect with increasing the level or improving the feed efficiency that growers can benefit from. Now, I think you mentioned it in this episode talking about soya and the EU derivative on soya that's going to come in at some point. When that'll be depends when they decide to pull the trigger or stop deferring it. But it's going to happen at some point, and we need to be ready to supply the market with alternatives. But it's not just the stick method there. There's a will from consumers, and there's a will from producers to use alternatives to soya.
So moving on to peas, which is one of the more developed areas for the list this year. We've got lots of new varieties on, as Chris Judge has just been explaining to us. MPZ is part of that as well. So do you want to talk us through your field pea offering for 25 and what else you've already got on the list? Because your name appears quite a few times, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We've really invested in pea breeding in the background to these varieties. So I can start with yellows because they appear at the top of the list. We've got Concerto available now this year. So it did join the list a year ago. But as we know, with these large seeded crops, multiplying them up, sometimes they come on the list and they need a few years of multiplying before they get there. Now, Concerto looked so good in the very early stages that we started multiplying it quite early. So in only year two, we come to the market with actually a decent quantity of it. And that sits there up at the top end of the yellow pea list. And it's not just that it sits at the top for yield. It's also one of the very highest downy mildew scores, resistant to pea wilt. And it's got a really, really huge 1,000 seed weight, which will be very popular with processors and feeders, to be fair. So, that sits there very, very nicely. Although it's not new this year, it's should have a really, really strong year.
Yeah, well, I think we talked about it last year, didn't we? But it wasn't. Yeah, like you say, that the seed wasn't available in quantity, as you quite often find with seed varieties. Just to put some numbers around that, the descriptive list downy mildew score for Concerto is a 7, and the 1,000 seed weight is 365, which is quite some way ahead of everything else on the yellow, certainly. But sorry, Michael, carry on.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Pangaea then adds onto the list this year as a new green pea variety, and the way I've sort of described this is you've got a Carrington like pea that's much bigger, and I think Carrington has had a really good time on farm the past few years, and it will continue to do so because agronomically it's a great variety. And then that leads on to our new Marifat variety Midori, and I don't think it needs much introduction when you look at the list. It sticks out there a mile. Really, really high yielding Marifat variety. Slightly taller than the other Marifats that are on there. It's also got a nice big seed size. So it's a very similar size to Sakura, which is, well, as growers of Marifats will know, has been the accepted variety in the market for quite a number of years now. So Midori is a really exciting step forward in Marifat yield potential, and we're not losing out on seed size within that, which is an exciting place to be. Now it puts us back in that position of Midori will be going into another year of seed production, but it's there ready for growers, and hopefully in spring 26 it'll be ready to go.
Yeah, Midori yield of 103% there for those, which is an uplift from its next closest variety at 99 there. But obviously there's a lot more, as we always say about the descriptive list, there's a lot more to it than just yield. We do look at the whole point of this exercise is the overall package, as Michael's alluded to. So a good showing from MPZ this year. Just more broadly on the market, Michael, I know you're very positive about pulses, you always have been. What are your current feelings towards the market? It hasn't been a year without its challenges one way or another. So as we sit here today, how are you feeling about the outlook for pulses?
Yeah, I think I can approach the question from two ways, but how I'm feeling is when you look at pulses, what they can do for a lot of the environmental and food challenges, a health challenge which we're facing in the UK, you can only really put a positive spin on what the potential is for them. They offer something that's probably quite rare in agriculture, and I'm going to mention the three-letter SFI term, but actually pulses fit so many of the SFI goals, and what's holding them back is the fact that they also produce a food crop. And if that point is recognised, then I would see a massive, massive uplift in the pulse area, because essentially you're benefiting growers by giving them the opportunity to hit their environmental goals while also producing a food crop. And that is what the growers we all speak to really want to do. Now, sustainable farming has got to be at the forefront of everyone's minds in the industry, because we know the climate risks that we're facing. And to me, pulses are the epitome of it. They are sustainable farming. And let's not forget, they go on to benefit the following first wheat crop. And that is what most farmers are making their money out of.
I mean, we've talked a number of times about how pulses and vegetable legumes fit into this sort of utopia, if you like, of how we help feed the world and solve some of the environmental problems that exist in the countryside. And you've just alluded to it there, but what do you think is the key to unlocking that potential? Is there one thing that you wish we could just do to be able to unlock that potential and make governments realize, incentivize farmers to grow more of the crop? What is it that we need to do? Because it feels like it's obvious, it feels like the end game is obvious, and it feels like all the right components are there, but how do we unlock that door?
You're right that everything's there, and actually government know it, but we have to just get some joined up thinking and support joined up thinking there. They do know it because the Innovate grants are supporting pulses, projects like the NCS project, the Answers project that we're involved in. There is investment in helping pulses to be a major crop. On the other hand, I don't think that the government are seeing the damage that is being caused by some SFI options that perhaps offer the same benefits as pulses. And I think the one thing that we would like to see is pulses not get sidelined for something that does the same thing. And I'm loosely alluding to NUM3, for example, here, a legume fallow mix, where actually the payment for that particular option with an average pulse crop is probably a similar gross margin opportunity. But we want to see the pulse crop recognized for bringing more than just the environmental benefits.
Well, I think we can share those sentiments, and thanks for summing those up for us and for your time this afternoon joining us.
So thanks to Heather and to Michael for their inserts into this episode, and indeed to Chris. Thanks for joining us, Chris, and explaining what's on the 2025 list. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure you hit the like button and subscribe, because you'll then get alerted every time we've got a new episode to share with you. And also, if you're listening on your usual podcast provider's website, make sure you subscribe to be alerted to every new episode. That way, there'll be lots of new content coming soon, so stay tuned. But until then, thanks very much for listening.